Anya hustled down the street toward the subway station where she intended to catch a train back to Brooklyn. She had only walked a few blocks before she felt a stranger's eyes upon her again, just as she had the other day. In the middle of the block, she abruptly stopped and bent down to tie her shoe, glancing backward as she did so. Maybe it was because it was getting dark and they didn't think they'd be seen, or maybe they just didn't expect her to be as aware of her surroundings as she was, Anya didn't know. But whatever the reason, her little stunt worked. About a block and a half back, two men abruptly stopped and turned away from her. One pretended to be examining a magazine stand, and the other pulled a cell phone out of his pocket and acted as if he was answering a call. The man in front was short and thick, with shoulders that looked as if they belonged on an NFL linebacker. His shaved head gleamed in the streetlights. His partner was taller and thinner, with a thick head of wavy hair and a goatee. Both were dressed in dark pants, shirts, and jackets. Anya stood and continued walking, but this time she glanced back over her shoulder a few times, watching the men behind her. They clearly weren't from New York, as they hadn't yet developed a New Yorker's odd talent for moving through a crowded sidewalk without disturbing the slower pedestrian traffic moving around them. Anya slipped through the crowd, moving easily with the changing patterns of those around her. Her pursuers plowed their own path, and it was this disturbance in the natural flow that had caught her eye and let her know that they were still back there. Even as she watched, the two men quickened their pace, obviously trying to close the distance between themselves and Anya. She wasn't about to let that happen.
Let's see if I can flush the foxes out of the hen house.
She broke into a run. Her sudden move caught them off guard, and her long legs allowed her to widen the distance between them in those first few seconds, giving her some precious lead time. She raced across the traffic against the light. She barged through the crowd standing on the opposite corner and shot down the street perpendicular to the direction she'd been traveling in, headed for the subway station on Broadway a block and a half away. By the time she reached it, she had widened her lead to almost two whole blocks. Unfortunately, her pursuers had doubled in number as well, for as she stopped for a moment at the top of the steps leading down to the subway station, she could see four men shoving their way through the crowd toward her. Time to go, she told herself, and raced down the steps two at a time. At the bottom, she caught sight of a couple of transit cops standing around chatting, and she momentarily considered getting them involved, but decided against it at the last minute. If it was the Dragon's men behind her, and really, who else could it be, then she didn't want to drag them into her mess. Instead, she charged forward, vaulted the turnstile, and dashed down the steps in front of her, headed for the center platform. The station serviced four different sets of tracks, two northbound and two southbound. The center platform would give her access to one of each, which seemed her best bet at the moment. When she had managed to lose her pursuers, she could always get off at another stop, cross over to the opposite platform, and head back the other way if necessary. The little magazine and snack stand was selling Mets caps for $15, so she hurriedly bought one and, stuffing her hair up underneath it, jammed it on her head. She thought about grabbing a pair of sunglasses while she was at it, but decided against it. She didn't want anything to hinder her vision of the people around her. There was a commotion on the stairs, and Anya turned away, not wanting to be caught gawking and give herself away. She moved down the platform and then looked back the way she had come. Her original pursuers were coming down the stairs, shoving people out of the way when they didn't move fast enough.
Hey, asshole, who you shoving, huh?
As she watched, a young college student angrily tried to push back and ended up being tossed down the stairs for his trouble. That got people's attention, and they cleared a path, allowing her pursuers to descend that much faster. A glance to her right at the northbound platform showed that her other two pursuers were already amid the crowd over there, searching for her. Where the heck was the train? She looked down the tracks, hoping to see the telltale glow of the oncoming light, but only the darkness stared back at her. For a second, she thought about jumping off the platform and disappearing into the tunnels, but she wasn't desperate enough yet to take a chance of getting caught on the tracks with an inbound train. When she turned back toward the crowd, she saw that her pursuers had reached the bottom of the steps and were on the platform itself. They stopped for a moment, talking it over, and then one headed her way while one went the other. If she was going to reach the stairs, she was going to have to confront at least one of them. Anya knew she couldn't count on the crowd to keep her hidden forever. Sooner or later, one of them was going to catch a glimpse of her, and then she'd have to deal with all four of them together. Going on the offensive, while they were still separated from each other, seemed like a smart move, and it didn't take her long to decide to do just that. She began to work her way through the crowd back in the direction that she'd come from, keeping her face averted as much as possible. As she drew closer to where the bald man stood searching for her, she gradually drifted in his direction. When she was only a few feet away, she stopped and waited for him to close the distance. He was trying to see over the heads of the people around them when Anya stepped up beside him.
Looking for me?
As he spun to face her, Anya delivered a massive punch to his right temple, stunning him. She followed it with a left cross to the chin, slamming his head back. He dropped to the ground like a felled tree. The crowd around them suddenly backed away, the typical New York response to trouble, stay out of it. Anya was ready to deliver another blow, but realized she didn't need to. He was out cold, at least for the time being. Her frontal assault had an unintended consequence, however. From the platform across the way, she could see a number of commuters gesticulating in her direction. Aware of the movement of the crowd, her pursuers glanced in the direction the commuters were pointing. They saw Anya at the same time she saw them. Time to go, she thought to herself. She turned, ready to make a dash for the stairs and the freedom they represented, only to find herself looking down the barrel of a very ugly handgun.
I don't think so, Miss Creed. You coming with me?
No!
Anya's left hand came up, grabbing the gunman's left wrist, sending the gun away from her face and pulling him forward and down. Anya was still in motion, pivoting on the balls of her feet and using the swing of her hips to bring her right arm around in a vicious arc that ended against the side of his head. Then she delivered a hammer strike to the face with her left hand as she completed the circle she'd started with the first blow. Her assailant staggered but did not go down. Just then, a northbound train pulled into the station on the tracks next to her. The gunman was shaking his head, trying to clear it, as he brought his arm back up, searching for a target. Anya's right foot came up in a scissor kick to his head. He dropped to the ground, the gun spinning out of his hand across the platform. Anya turned, intent on going after it. As she dove to the side, desperately trying to get out of the line of fire, she saw the other two gunmen standing at the top of the stairs, firing down at her. She hit the ground and rolled for cover behind a nearby column. Several other people were already huddled there, and Anya knew that if she didn't get out soon, it wouldn't be long before some innocent bystander was caught in the crossfire and seriously injured or killed. The train across the platform had discharged its passengers out the opposite side, and now the doors on her side swished open. She could hear the conductor's voice indicating what the next stop would be. The fresh barrage of gunfire kept everyone in place and under cover. No one headed for the open doors. Anya chanced to look around the pillar she was using as cover and was astounded to see a second group of men shooting at the first set from the cover of the magazine stand at the other end of the platform.
Who the heck are they?
While they kept the first group distracted, Anya surged to her feet and raced for the doors of the subway car even as they began to close. With a final burst of speed and a huge downward thrust of her long athletic legs, Anya launched herself like a missile at the closing doors of the subway car. Anya shot through the opening just as the doors closed behind her. She tucked herself into a ball, careered into a metal pole, bounced off that, and then slammed to a stop against the closed doors on the other side of the train. She climbed cautiously to her feet. Several passengers were staring at her open-mouthed, and she was sure she looked quite the spectacle after a stunt like that. But Anya didn't care. She'd survived. That was all that mattered. She felt the car lurch into motion beneath her.
Whoa!
Anya dove to the floor. Safety glass went flying, and through the opening, Anya could see her two pursuers racing toward her, guns extended. Behind them, she could also see her first assailant, the bald man, back on his feet and closing the distance as well. The lead gunman threw himself against the door and hung on, letting the train carry him with it. With the glass in the windows gone, he was able to stick his arm inside the train and point his gun at her. Anya hurled herself down the center aisle and away from the door. Several passengers went down in a shower of blood. With so many passengers watching, Anya didn't dare draw her sword. She scrambled forward on hands and knees, trying to reach the door to the next car, while around her the other passengers huddled in terror.
God damn it! Somebody help me open this door! Quick!
Her pursuer turned his attention to getting inside the subway car before the motion of the train or some hanging piece of equipment swept him off the outside. Anya rose to her feet, hauled back the lever to open the door, and stepped onto the narrow platform connecting her car to the next. She stepped across to the next car, hauled open that door, and disappeared inside.
Stay down!
They did, cowering in their seats. She kept moving forward, rushing for the other end of the car as fast as she could, and counting on the passengers to get out of her way. 2-1, they all did. Must be the sword, Anya thought with a smile. She guessed she was 7, maybe 8 cars from the end of the train. She made it through 6 of those cars before her pursuers caught up to her, which was pretty damn good, all things considered. It just wasn't good enough.
Hold it right there!
Slowly, Anya turned to face her assailant. 3 of them stood there. The bald man, the guy with the goatee, and one of the newcomers. The 4th man wasn't there, but Anya didn't bother to ask where he was.
Put down the sword and kick it over here.
Knowing she'd reached the end of the line, Anya did as she was told. She bent down and put the sword on the floor. Then, before she could change her mind, she kicked it along the length of the car toward the bald man. When she looked up again, over their shoulders, Anya saw an astounding sight. The 2nd group of gunmen she'd seen at the subway station was cautiously making their way toward the group ahead of them. Anya had no idea who they were or what they wanted. All she knew was that their guns were now pointed at the other shooters, rather than at her, and that was good enough for now. The gunman hadn't noticed them yet.
I see you invited a few more guests to the party.
The gunman turned as one to look behind them. Anya willed the sword back to the otherwhere and turned to escape. Anya instinctively ducked into a crouch to present a smaller target, but she needn't have worried. The 2 groups were blazing away at each other and weren't paying attention to her. She ran for the last car. On the other side of the door, a few scattered passengers were watching the gunplay behind them as if it were a spectator sport, and Anya grimaced. Only in New York. Crossing the car, she came to the final door on the train. Looking through its window, she could see a small platform on the other side, and just beyond it, the tunnel itself. If she could get off the train... The door, of course, was locked to prevent people from doing the very thing she was about to do. Not that that was going to be a hindrance. Everyone's attention was on the gun battle going on in the car behind her. Anya shoved the sword right through the lock, and the door popped open. Rather than trying to haul her sword back out of the splintered steel of the door, Anya simply let it go. The sword vanished, leaving a gaping hole in the lock. Anya stepped out onto the tiny platform at the end of the train. A small metal railing that came up to her mid-thigh was all that kept her from falling off the back of the train. The wind whipped all around her as the conductor tried to slow the train down and bring it to a stop as a result of all the shooting. There was a ladder bolted to the subway car on her left, but since it led to the roof of the train, she ignored it. With the ceiling of the tunnel so low, climbing up there was practically suicide, which meant she didn't have many options available to her. She could either go back the way she had come, or she could get off the train. A quick glance back into the car showed her pursuers passing through the door at the other end. They would figure out where she had gone in just a few seconds, and if they caught her on the platform, it was all over. Knowing that if she gave it any real thought, she'd chicken out, Anya backed up a few steps until she was against the door, then took a running start and launched herself over the rail and off the train. She hit the ground hard and rolled, her arms and legs tucked in tight to avoid hitting the rails nearby. She sprang to her feet and headed down the tunnel as fast as she could run. In the back of her mind, she marveled at the fact that she had just jumped off a moving train and survived, but the other half of her chalked it up to the sword's influence on her physical abilities and left it at that. The important thing was that she had gotten away. The tunnel curved to the right a few feet ahead, and she ran for all she was worth, praying that she could get around the bend before a bullet found her flesh. She sped past the curve and was out of range, at least for a few minutes. The tunnel smelled of dirt and exhaust and a thousand other things she couldn't identify. It was dimly lit by a series of bare bulbs hanging on the left-hand wall every 10 feet. There was just enough light for her to see, so she hurried along as fast as she could, staying to the middle of the tracks and trying to be careful where she put her feet. Anya pushed herself, trying to put as much distance between them and herself as she could. The tunnel branched several times, and she let intuition be her guide, making a left here, a right there, until she realized that she was no longer certain she was even on the same track. At that point, she slowed down to a walk to try to figure things out. She hadn't yet come upon another subway station, so she had no way of knowing where she was. Common sense told her to keep moving in one direction. Eventually, she had to hit another station, and from there she could gain access to the street. So far, she hadn't seen any trains, either. Maybe traffic control had shut them down temporarily. While moving through the tunnels, she noticed a shallow niche in the wall every 100 yards or so. She knew these were emergency nooks designed for the transit workers to use in the event that they were accidentally caught in the tunnel with a moving train. The niches weren't much more than hollowed-out spaces in the walls, roughly half a foot deep, if that. But she figured they were enough if you kept your head about you and stayed put until the train passed. She kept walking. After a few more minutes, the earth around her began to vibrate with a steady rhythm, and she knew that the trains were up and running again. That made her more nervous than she wanted to admit. If something happened, there wasn't any place she could go. She had to find a subway station, and soon. Anya was just starting to wish she'd headed in the other direction at one of the previous forks she'd encountered, when a pursuer caught up to her. He charged her out of the darkness. He rammed his shoulder into her midriff and lifted her with his forward momentum. They careered across the width of the tunnel. The man slammed her bodily against a nearby column supporting the roof above. He kept the pressure on, using his arms to pummel her sides with his massive fists. She brought her right knee up sharply, hammering it into his stomach, but it was like hitting a concrete block with a rubber mallet. She did it again and again, but had no greater luck with her subsequent blows than she had with the first. They just bounced off him. The man was a human tank, it seemed. All the while, he kept up the punishment with his fists. Her hands moved spider-like over his face, searching. He twisted his head, trying to get away, but she managed to find an eye socket with one hand and rammed her thumb into it. The man stumbled backward, his hands going to his face. Anya stumbled away, fighting to clear her head, knowing that he would be on her again in seconds. Anya straightened up, blinking back the darkness that had threatened to overwhelm her. The bald man stood a few feet away, shaking his head like a dog, trying to clear the fluids running down his face.
I'm gonna kill you for that!
He charged forward. Anya dropped into a crouch, and as he rushed forward, she grabbed the front of his shirt with both hands. She went over backward, using her hands and feet to toss him up and over her head as she rolled. He slammed to the ground, dazed, and Anya didn't waste any time. She was already there, sword in hand, the point at his throat.
Who sent you? What do you want?
Anya spun around, looking down the tunnel. A light flared there in the depths. A train was coming down the tracks, right toward them. Anya ran like the devil himself was on her heels. She chanced to look back, noting that her opponent was up and on his feet, chasing after her as fast as he could go, and that the train had closed half the distance between them already, with no sign of slowing down. She faced forward and kept going, her gaze frantically scanning the walls on either side. Then she saw one of the emergency niches, barely visible amid the darkness of the tunnel. She flung herself into the niche against the far wall, squeezing her body in as deep as she could get it. The man pursuing her was still 10 feet away.
Run! You're
Anya turned her face away at the last instant, pressing her cheek against the cold concrete behind her and trying to shrink back into the wall itself. The train had flashed by just inches from her face as the conductor realized that there had been something more than just the usual rats in the tunnel, and he tried to bring the train to a stop, but he was far too late. As Anya was running from her pursuers in the tunnels beneath Midtown Manhattan, a Gulfstream aircraft under private ownership arrived at Kennedy International Airport. Aboard were Henshaw, Rue, and a half dozen of Henshaw's operatives he'd decided to bring over to help supplement the team that was already in place. They passed through customs without difficulty and then split into two groups. Henshaw accompanied Rue to the car he had waiting outside, while his men headed for the safe house in Brooklyn overlooking Anya's loft apartment. Henshaw would meet up with them later, once he was satisfied that Rue had been safely ensconced in his usual hotel. For a man like Rue, nothing but the Waldorf Astoria would do. He'd been staying there under a variety of names for more than 100 years, and saw no reason to change now. Exquisite accommodations, superb service, and a devotion to the privacy of their guests were the attributes Rue looked for in a hotel, and the Waldorf did not disappoint. Reaching the car, Henshaw dismissed the driver and took over that chore himself, not trusting anyone else to do it when he was personally available. He waited until Rue was buckled in and then eased out into traffic, ready for the hour-long drive through the Queens Midtown Tunnel and across Manhattan to where the hotel stood on Park Avenue and 50th. Along the way, Rue asked for an update on the intelligence that Henshaw had been gathering on the Dragon.
What little information we've been able to obtain seems to indicate that the Dragon became operational again about 3 years ago. He's done odd jobs here and there during that time, nothing too flashy, and certainly nothing along the lines of his previous activity. It is almost as if he was injured for a long while and is now testing his skills, learning again just what he is capable of.
But it is in for certain.
I believe so, sir. The hallmarks are there. The risky, maybe even reckless nature of the contracts he takes on, the precision in which they are carried out, the telltale symbol, the paper dragon, left behind at each scene.
Damn.
Henshaw had spoken to his people on the ground right after deplaning, and he brought Rue up to date with what he had learned about Anya's activities.
She went where?
To see a hypnotherapist.
Whatever for?
I don't know. Shall I have one of the men break into the therapist's office to obtain the records of her visit?
No, that's not necessary. At least, not yet. Anya will probably tell us herself.
Very good. Hello? Yes?
Henshaw listened to the caller for several minutes with considerable interest.
Very good, thank you. There's been a new development. The team was waiting outside the television studios where Ms. Creed is employed. She was chased into the underground and there was apparently a bit of a scuffle.
Was she injured?
No, sir. Our people involved themselves in the confrontation as soon as they were able to, and in the resulting confusion, she slipped away from both groups.
So she still doesn't know that we are watching her?
She clearly knows someone is watching, sir. But whether or not she has figured out that it is us is another question entirely. If I had to guess, I'd say no. Though it won't take her long to figure it out if we have to interfere again. Shall I call off the surveillance?
Heavens, no. Clearly she needs it. Tell your people to stay close.
Very good, sir.
They passed the rest of the ride in silence. Arriving at the Waldorf, Rue stepped out of the car and walked into the hotel, heading directly for the main dining room, intent on a late supper. He knew Henshaw would deal with the various details while he ate. Take care of checking him into the usual suite he reserved each time he stayed there, seeing that his bags were brought up and unpacked properly, even arranging for breakfast at the proper time in the morning. After all, it was what he paid Henshaw for, and Rue was not stingy with his personal comfort. Later, Rue was relaxing with an after-dinner brandy when Henshaw entered the room. His majordomo had changed out of his usual perfectly pressed suit into casual slacks and a windbreaker, both of which, as well as his athletic shoes, were a very deep blue in color. Rue nodded appreciatively. The color wouldn't look entirely out of place in a crowd, and the deep shade would actually help him to blend in better with the shadows than a pure black outfit.
Are you all set, sir?
I take it you're off to see our girl?
Yes, sir.
We need to find this dragon character. before he finds Anya Henshaw. Her life may depend on it.
We're working on it.
All right. I won't keep you.
Good night, sir.
There was little traffic at this time of night, and Henshaw made good time crossing from Manhattan over to Brooklyn. He located the correct street, then parked in the garage below the apartment building where his team had set up shop 2 days earlier. He rode the elevator to the fifth floor and walked to the entrance to apartment 9. After a moment, the door opened slightly, and Henshaw found himself looking down the barrel of a 9mm handgun. Its owner recognized him and led him through the door. The surveillance team of 8 individuals allowed him to box the target and handle the job properly. If one of them was in danger of being seen, then another member of the team could either step up or fall back, preventing them from blowing their cover because Anya had made some sudden move or change of direction. They thought she might have seen them the day before because she'd suddenly gone crazy, sprinting down side streets and dashing across traffic. But when she stopped right next to Olivia and didn't realize that she was part of the surveillance team, they knew she must have caught wind of someone else. That was when they figured out they weren't the only team on the job. They had relayed the information to Henshaw before he'd left France, and he'd given them explicit instructions what to do should they discover who, besides themselves, was following her. As it turned out, it was a good thing he had. Henshaw went into the kitchen where several of the team were congregating around a fast food dinner. He pulled up a chair next to Marco, the team leader.
Give me an update, please.
Marco did. He took Henshaw through the entire evening's operation, from when they had picked up Anya that morning outside her loft, all the way to their involvement in the confrontation between Anya and the Dragon's hit team in the subway tunnels hours later.
Where is she now?
She's back in her apartment. You can see her from her bedroom.
Who's got the watch?
Jesse and Dave.
All right. Good. Good job, everyone. Get some rest while you can, as I think things are going to start heating up and we want to be ready.
Yes, sir.
The lights in the bedroom were off, but there was a little light coming in through the window, at least enough to see the shapes of Jesse and Dave.
How's it going?
That woman's obsessed. You'd think she'd be exhausted after what happened down in the subway, but she acts as if it was just a walk in the park. She started practicing those crazy martial arts moves she does the minute she returned, and she hasn't stopped since.
Henshaw joined the two of them on the other side of the room. Without saying anything, Dave handed him the binoculars he'd been using to keep their charge in sight. Anya's building was across the street, and one over from the one they occupied. They were on the fifth floor, and she was on the fourth, giving them an excellent downward viewpoint into the loft she called home. She had the curtains open at the moment, and through them Henshaw could see her working out in the large open space in the middle of the room. She was dressed in a white tank top and a pair of gray sweatpants, with her hair pulled back into a ponytail and her feet bare. In her hands, she held her sword, and even as he watched, she threw herself into another sword kata with deadly concentration. Henshaw remembered the way she'd handled it that night at Ruse, and for the first time he realized just how good with it she had become. It was like an extension of her body as she twisted, turned, and flowed about the room in the midst of her practice. He sometimes had a hard time recognizing where the sword ended and she began. "Keep it up, Anya," he told her silently. "You might just need it." And she did keep it up, long into the night, with only her silent, watchful guardians to keep her company. Switzerland, 2003. It had been several years since Toshiro had pronounced Shizu ready to take her place in the world, and she had used the time as she'd been instructed, traveling and learning. She had grown up considerably in those years, her core toughened and her edge sharpened by what she had seen and done, just like a sword that is tested again and again until it is pronounced ready. Less than a week earlier, she had received a message through the special channels that had been set up just for that purpose, a series of dead drops and hidden internet communications. The message had asked her to travel to Switzerland. Sensei had a new mission for her. The summons had filled her with excitement, had shaken off the lethargy she'd been feeling for the past few months, and she quickly made the necessary arrangements. The address turned out to be a small, private chateau in the Alps, hidden at the end of a long road that she would have missed if she hadn't known what to look for to find the turnoff from the main road. She arrived late at night and had been met at the door by a manservant who led her to a room, stating that Sensei would see her in the morning. After breakfast, she'd been asked to join Sensei in the study. She entered the room to find him seated behind his desk, reading through a report. He pointed at a chair in front of the desk and went on reading without looking up. Obedient to his wishes, Shizu sat. After a few minutes, he put the report down, stood up, and looked down at her.
You are well, Shizu?
Yes, Sensei.
Do you know why I have asked you here today?
No, Sensei.
I have a mission for you, Shizu. Now, the time has come to set you on your way, to set you free, so that you can become all that you are destined to become. Are you ready, Shizu?
Only if you say I am, Sensei.
You are a weapon, Shizu, and it is time to point you at a target. Come, let me show you your purpose.
Sensei led Shizu across the room and into the next, which was set up like a command center. The walls were covered with charts and photographs and long stretches of dates and names. The tables were littered with boxes of files and computers running massive database searches. Sensei stepped into the center of the room. Raising his hands, he gestured at the information gathered around him.
A man died recently. His name is not important. In fact, I doubt we could find three people outside of those who have been in this room who could tell you what it actually was. He acquired a new identity long ago, one that he built into a legend, and it is that legend that I am interested in. Go on, take a look around.
It soon became apparent that the man, whatever his name, had been an international assassin of no little skill. His long list of targets included ambassadors, government ministers, diplomats, even bankers and prominent businessmen. They were from more than a dozen countries. He had been like a ghost, infiltrating heavily guarded locations to deliver death by his own hand rather than with a bullet or a bomb. And the more she read, the more respect and admiration Shizu felt for this man. The work he had done, the skill with which he had done it. Sensei must have noted her reaction.
He was known as the Dragon, and he elevated killing to an art form. You, Shizu, are going to take his place and be his successor.
Successor?
The man was unimportant, but the legend he created, the symbol he represented, that is something too precious to be lost. For the past 10 years, Shizu, I have been training you to revive the legend, to become the new dragon. Study what is here. Learn who he was, how he killed, what it was that let an ordinary man, a cheap killer, become the myth that the world feared. This chateau will be your home, your base of operations. The staff has been instructed to serve your every need, and there is money in an account to cover any expenses you might have. And when at last you are ready, I have a very special target for you.
The news the next morning was full of stories about the shootout in the subway. Only one of the television stations mentioned the mysterious woman who, they claimed, was at the heart of it all. Anya was relieved. The last thing she needed was to be in the middle of a major news story, never mind have someone recognize her as the host of Chasing History's Monsters. If they did, she'd have paparazzi camped out up and down her street. The police would certainly want to hear her side of the story as well, to say the least. She was happy to see the majority of the news channels were calling it a gang-related event, which she knew would sink people's interest in it faster than the Titanic. Besides, she had more important things to concentrate on. She knew that the sword the dragon carried was the key to the whole situation. If she could understand the weapon, she could understand its bearer. So, as soon as it was late enough the following morning, she made a series of phone calls and arranged to meet with Dr. Matthew Yi, curator of the Asian Hall at the American Museum of Natural History, and the closest thing that New York City had to an expert on samurai culture. He agreed to see her when she mentioned a Japanese sword with a dragon emblem etched into the blade. He had some free time late in the afternoon where he could fit her in, which meant that she had the whole morning to kill while she waited. She decided to pay a visit to the New York Public Library, specifically the research section, and see if they had any information on the dragon's past or present that she might not yet be aware of. The New York Public Library actually consisted of 89 separate libraries, 4 non-lending research libraries, 4 main lending libraries, a library for the blind and physically handicapped, and 77 neighborhood branch libraries in the 3 boroughs it served. But it was the building on 5th Avenue between 40th and 42nd Streets that most people thought of when the library came to mind. The 2 stone statues of the lions outside the main entrance, named Fortitude and Patience, seemed to guard the entrance from unwanted troublemakers and were the public face of the library the world over. As Anya walked past them on her way into the building, she gave the closest one a quick pat on the head.
Good kitty.
The library held in excess of 50 million items, from books to periodicals to film and video. She hoped that somewhere in all that data she could find something new to help her understand just why the dragon had taken an interest in her. She started with the periodicals first. The assassinations had occurred in different countries, but the targets had all been prominent enough that the American media had reported on them as well. Unfortunately, the reports were dry, devoid of all but the most basic of facts. And Anya gleaned little from them that she didn't already know. Her fluency in several languages allowed her to check out some of the foreign editions, too, but the end result was the same. After an hour, Anya decided to switch tactics. If she couldn't find anything specific about the dragon, maybe she could track down the dragon's sword. Much of what she uncovered in the next hour was material she already knew, such as the fact that Japanese swords were classified by the length of the blade, with the shortest being a tanto and the longest being a katana, and that the majority of them came from 5 houses, or schools, of craftsmanship. She discovered a catalog of signatures for swordsmiths all the way back to the 12th century, but none of the images matched the one she had drawn while in her trance. There were a few that were close, and she made a note to ask Dr. Yi about them later. The dragon had noted the watchers of Anya's apartment the day before. They were good, not just good enough. And sometimes it was that little bit that made all the difference in who came out on top. Like now. Dressed as a plumber in a grease-stained coverall and driving a battered old van, the dragon showed up outside Anya's apartment building about 15 minutes after she had departed. The building had a security gate, but getting inside was just a matter of pressing several of the buttons on the directory and waiting for someone to hit the buzzer without bothering to ask who it was. It didn't take more than 2 tries. It rarely did. Once inside the building, the dragon went directly to Anya's apartment on the 4th floor and pretended to be waiting for someone to answer the door. A long look around showed that the hall was empty. So out of the tool bag the dragon was carrying came a crowbar. The locks themselves might be sturdy, but the wood around them was as old as the rest of the building. It didn't take long to pop the locks and gain entry. The loft was an open floor plan, with a large window occupying one entire side. Thankfully, the curtains had been left drawn, and the dragon didn't have to worry about the observers across the way taking note of what was happening. At first, the dragon just stood there in the center of the room, soaking up the atmosphere of the place, trying to get a feeling for the woman who lived there. There was a sense of a life lived in constant motion, of comings and goings, without any real time in between. It felt more like a way station than a home to the dragon, a not unfamiliar feeling. After that, the loft was searched quickly, efficiently, and with the kind of care that would make it nearly impossible to prove that anyone had gone through the place. If cabinets were opened, they were closed again. If objects were moved, they were put back in the exact position as before. The dragon wasn't looking for anything in particular. Just the opposite, in fact. The goal was to learn as much about the target as possible, and the best place to do that was in the target's own home. That was where people felt safe, where they were free to let their hair down and be themselves, where all the secrets they kept hidden from the world were revealed. The types of clothing they wore, the magazines they read, the shows they recorded on their DVRs, all these things could reveal important character quirks that might help the dragon complete the assignment. There were some interesting facts on display in the apartment. The clothing in the closet and the wardrobe indicated a woman who was comfortable in her appearance. She didn't need fancy clothing to make her feel more feminine or attractive. The books scattered throughout the place indicated a curious mind, one that was able to compartmentalize a whole host of topics at the same time, if the number of volumes that held bookmarks were any indication of her current reading habits. The food in the pantry, or rather the lack thereof, gave mute witness to the fact that this was a woman who rarely cooked for herself. In one corner of the apartment, the dragon found a padded workout area and a wall covered with a collection of martial arts weapons. A sai, a pair of bokken, a bow staff, assorted throwing knives of different lengths and weights, even two different sets of samurai swords. The weapons came from a variety of countries and a mix of styles. Forget being proficient. If she even had a working knowledge of all of them, she would be an opponent worth fighting. The mix of ancient pottery, artifacts, and mementos from dig sites across the world supported the dragon's view of the woman as being a modern nomad. She was in so many other places that she did not have time to be at home. Nearly half an hour had passed since the dragon had entered the apartment, and that was pushing it. The target might come back at any moment, so it was time to finish and get out of there. The final bits of stage dressing didn't take long. The tool bag was a bit heavier upon exiting than it had been on entry, but that couldn't be helped. The dragon left the building, climbed back inside the van, and drove off. The items that had been taken from the apartment would be tossed into various dumpsters a few blocks away. They were just window dressing, after all. Anya stepped away from the stairs and noticed the damaged door right away. It hung slightly open, and even from this distance she could see the gouges in the frame where a crowbar or tire iron had been used to force the locks.
Crap!
Anya considered returning to the street and calling the cops. After all, the thief might still be inside. But she'd faced down much worse than a punk involved in a little breaking and entering, so she decided to have a look around first. If she still needed the cops, then she'd make the call. She approached her apartment and cautiously pushed the door open the rest of the way. She stood in the doorway, listening for sounds of someone moving about inside, but didn't hear anything. Emboldened, she stepped inside the apartment and closed the door behind her with her foot. With sword in hand, she made a thorough search of the premises. When she was satisfied that she was alone, that the thief had long since fled, she sent the sword away and tried to make a list of what was missing. It didn't take her long. Her Blu-ray player, her Xbox console, and a few other assorted electronics, stuff that could be pawned off easily without too much of a hassle. Her passport and other documentation were still in the desk drawer where she normally left them, and none of the artifacts in her collection had been disturbed, which led her to believe that this was a simple smash and grab. The fact that the thief had chosen her apartment rather than the one on the third floor was pure chance, it seemed. Or was it? She wondered if there might be a connection between the events of the past few days and the break-in. But after giving it some thought, she dismissed the idea as being just a bit too paranoid. Unless the dragon had suddenly taken a liking to Guitar Hero 4, she couldn't see any reason for her stuff to be missing. No, she decided it had to be a simple B&E. And the truth was that break-ins like this happened all the time in New York, and Anya had been around long enough to know that the cops wouldn't be able to do much about it. Maybe her stuff would turn up, maybe it wouldn't. They weren't going to go out of their way to track down a petty thief with all the other problems the city had. A glance at the clock told her it was getting late. She didn't have much time before she had to get to her meeting with Dr. Yi. The police report could wait, she decided. It was only for insurance purposes, anyway. She had to get the door fixed. It cost her extra to get the guy to come out immediately, but inside of an hour, she had the door frame fixed and new locks installed. By then, it was time for her to leave for her appointment. As Anya pulled up in a cab in front of the museum's entrance on Central Park West, with its towering white columns and its bronze statue of President Theodore Roosevelt on horseback, Anya was hopeful that Dr. Yi's expertise could fill in the missing pieces that her research that morning had not. With his help, maybe she could identify the sword. The museum was one of the largest in the country, with 42 permanent exhibits and a handful of temporary ones at any given time. Its massive stone edifice stretched out over several city blocks, attracting tourists just for its architecture alone. Even in midweek, it was busy, and Anya stood in the foyer for a moment, trying to decide the best course of action to take in order to find Dr. Yi. She approached a guard.
Pardon me. I'm here to see Dr. Yi.
I'm Dr. Yi. You're Miss Creed, I take it.
Yes, I am. Thanks for agreeing to see me, Dr. Yi.
Dr. Yi turned out to be a good-looking guy in his mid-30s, with a quick smile and an encyclopedic knowledge of Japanese culture, from the early Heian period to the Meiji Restoration and the dismantling of the samurai class.
It's a pleasure to meet you, Miss Creed. I must say that you're not quite what I was expecting.
Anya, please. And why is that?
While all geeks might dream of meeting a beautiful woman with knowledge about a legendary sword, very few of us actually believe it will ever happen, and even fewer get to fulfill that dream. And you can call me Matthew, by the way.
Thanks, Matthew.
Come on, we can talk in my office.
Yi led Anya down the hall to a door marked staff and removed a plastic key card from his pocket, which he swiped through a security reader next to the door. He pulled the door open and held it for her. He resumed his position beside her as they walked through the maze of corridors on the other side. Anya had done a few odd jobs for the museum and had been there before, but she still couldn't help but peer inside each room as they passed, looking to see what treasures they were unearthing elsewhere in the world. They finally reached their destination, a corner office overlooking the park, and Anya's estimation of the power Dr. Yi held within the museum hierarchy rose a few notches. Then she noticed the beautifully restored yoroi, or samurai battle armor, standing in one corner. The black leather and gleaming iron was set off by the glaring aspect of the battle mask, or mempo, that sat atop the figure. She stepped closer, intrigued.
Like it?
It's gorgeous.
Yi stepped closer and pointed at the gold filigree that formed the shadow of a butterfly in the center of the chest piece.
Isn't it, though? See the butterfly pattern?
Yes.
It's a symbol of one of the minor houses of the Taira clan, who favored it for its elegant symmetry and delicate design. Unfortunately, they were wiped out by the Minamoto clan at the Battle of Dannoura in 1185, and very few of their arms and armor remain intact. It took me 14 months of around-the-clock work to restore this one to the shape it is in today, but it was worth every second. I've been meaning to add it to the Hall of Asian Peoples all week, but somehow, every time I go to do so, I find some excuse to keep it here for a few days longer. Silly of me, I know, but I just love to look at it. I'm sorry. Where are my manners? Please, have a seat. Now, what can I do for you?
Anya explained that in order to help support her time in the field, she occasionally took on privately funded work confirming the provenance of various items for museums, auction houses, and the like.
About a week ago, I was asked to investigate a man's claims that the katana he had in his possession was of a unique nature, with serious historical value. He plans on auctioning it off in a few weeks and wanted to get a better understanding of the market value before doing so.
This is the weapon you mentioned on the phone?
Yes. I've never seen anything like it, and I'm concerned by that. My knowledge of weaponry is fairly extensive, and I can recognize many of the primary swordsmiths from the period, but this is one I've never seen before.
Given the number of swordsmiths who have practiced the art through the years, it's not surprising that you didn't recognize one of the minor houses. There were literally hundreds of them, though they could all be traced back eventually to the Big Five.
Right. The Yamato, Yamashiro, Bizen, Soshu, and Mino.
Very good.
The collector in question wouldn't turn over the sword even temporarily for an independent examination, nor would he allow any photographs to be taken for fear that they would leak onto the internet. But I took the time to recreate the etching and the Mei by hand, and I have that for you to examine.
The Mei was a set of kanji characters on the end of the blade just above the hilt, the signature of the artist who created it. She'd tried to identify it through the usual channels, but hadn't had any luck. She took the page from her backpack that contained the drawing of the sword and passed it over to Dr. Yi. A little self-consciously, he removed a pair of wire-framed glasses from his pocket, put them on, and then took the drawing from her to have a look. Anya watched as his expression grew more intent, and he pulled the picture closer to his face for a better look.
This is the Mei exactly as you saw it on the blade?
The mark was worn and faded, so I'm not 100% certain. Why?
We're faced with two possibilities here. If the mark is complete, as it is, then I have to admit that I am not familiar with the swordsmith who fashioned it either. That would mean he would have been a very minor player and would disprove your client's claim that the weapon was of serious historical value.
Dr. Yi got up and came back around his desk to stand next to her, holding the drawing so she could see it.
However, if we assume that the Mei is, in fact, incomplete due to the condition of the blade, and we add one little mark here...
Yi drew a single short line extending outward from the edge of the rest.
Well then, I'd have to say that not only is the sword of rather important historical significance, but it just might be the archaeological find of the century with regard to Japanese history. Never mind, for all practical purposes, priceless.
Okay, I'll play along. Let's say that I did miss that little mark. It is small, as you said, and it is in an area of the blade that is rather worn, so it's possible that's exactly what happened. What does that mean? Who created the sword?
I'd bet my career that Sengo Muramasa fashioned that sword. And if he did, it isn't just any sword, but the last sword he ever produced, the famed Juyuchi Yosamu, 10,000 Cold Knights.
I know I've heard the name Muramasa, but I don't remember where and in what context. I don't know much about him, though.
I'm not surprised. There was a definite campaign to eradicate his work from history, and most of the references that survive today are so fanciful in nature that most think he was just a figure of myth and folklore. It couldn't be farther from the truth. Come on, let's go down to the hall so I can show you a few things, and I'll tell you about Muramasa on the way.
Yi went on to explain that Muramasa had been one of the most accomplished swordsmiths in all of Japanese history, second only to Soshu Masamune himself. Both men lived and worked in the Kamakura period.
In fact, there is a legend that a contest was organized between the two to see who could produce the finer blade. The contest was designed so that each man would dip his sword into a small stream with the cutting edge facing the current. Muramasa went first, plunging his weapon into the flow of the river. Anything and everything that passed by the weapon, from the drifting leaves in the current, to the fish that swam in the depths, to the very air hissing by the blade, was cut in two.
They stopped for a moment while Yi negotiated a locked set of doors with a pass card and a key ring. Then they continued.
Next, it was Masamune's turn. He lowered his sword into the water and waited patiently. Everything that came toward the blade was redirected around it, unharmed and undamaged. From the leaves to the fish to the air itself, all of them passed around the blade without resistance. As you can imagine, Muramasa was certain that he had won the challenge. After all, his sword had cut everything, and wasn't that the purpose of a sword? He began to insult Masamune for his poor weapon. But a wandering monk had witnessed the whole affair, and he offered his own conclusions. The first blade is, of course, a worthy blade, but it is a bloodthirsty, evil blade that does not discriminate between who it will cut and who it will spare. The other blade, on the other hand, was clearly the finer of the two, for it did not needlessly cut or destroy that which is innocent.
An interesting tale.
Ah, but it gets better. It really does. The reason that you are most likely not familiar with Muramasa blades is that they gained a reputation for being evil swords that lusted after blood. Some even thought that such a blade should not be resheathed until it had drawn blood. Doing anything less was terribly bad luck.
So what about the dragon etching? What does that tell us?
That is how I recognize the sword as possibly being the Juyuchi Yosamo. You see, Muramasa's name has not enjoyed the fame it deserved because the shogun, Tokugawa Ieyasu, ordered his blades outlawed and destroyed whenever found. Regardless of whether or not the blades were actually evil, they did seem to have a negative effect on the Tokugawa house. Kiriyasu, the grandfather of the first shogun, was cut in two in 1535 when his retainer attacked him with the Muramasa blade. Ieyasu's father, Matsu Daira, was killed by another man wielding a Muramasa blade, and even Ieyasu cut himself severely on his own wakizashi, or short sword, which was also made by Muramasa. When his own son was beheaded with a Muramasa blade, the shogun had finally had enough. He banned their creation, possession, and use throughout the entire empire.
By now, they had entered the public areas of the museum, and they cut across a busy exhibit hall.
The response to the shogun's edict was mixed. Many went out and sold off their Muramasa blades, hoping that no one else had yet heard the news that they were about to become worthless. Others defaced the blades, scraping off the meiji so that no one could tell that it was a Muramasa blade. A few hoarded the weapons, believing they might bring them personal power and financial gain. Those who were found to be hiding Muramasa blades were often executed on the spot, including the magistrate of Nagasaki, who, in 1634, was discovered to be hoarding more than 24 Muramasa blades.
At last, they reached the Asian Hall, which, as fortune would have it, was actually closed until the morning for renovations of the existing displays. With his pass card, Yi let them inside.